Hello, listeners, and welcome to the Poetry Salon Cast. I am Tricia Faye Hefner.
And I'm Douglas Manuel.
On each episode, we interview one of our favorite poets to ask about their latest book.
What was difficult and what was easy about writing it.
And my favorite question, what do they do with a rough draft that wants to play rough?
If you want to hear more about the writers we interview and work with them in person, you can attend a live reading and workshop with them at the Poetry Salon.
Find out more and register for great workshops and events with us and our favorite poets at www.thepoetrysalon.com.
Now, without further ado, welcome to this week's episode of the Poetry Salon Cast.
Hello, everyone. You are listening to the Poetry Salon Cast. Today, we have on the Salon Cast, Megan Sterling.
This poem is Before School, There Are Icicles. Before school, there are icicles clattering on the frosted snow. A dozen of them that gave way and fell together. Music like tin chords on strings of wind. Microscopic piano notes ringing across the tunnel between buildings. And we are delighted. Echo of winter morning, sharper for all the lonely air. No birds to fill the sky, no clouds. Only the vibrant blue like our heads thrown back. Branches encased in ice completely as though struck by a spell. And we sing. The sky is a million mirrors. The sky wears the tips of the branches like the diamond frills of the Elizabethans. And we crown it queen. Shadow of sun across the glass driveway, and I try to nudge my daughter toward the car, playing freeze tag, desperate not to slip. She asks for icicles to suck, so we leap from tree to tree as I break off the dangling bits, cold threatening to cut exposed skin, flesh of my hands raw, each tender icicle like a finger prick of good for her to taste, something of the tree in it. Something of the sky. I'm sort of undecided about the next one.
Trust yourself, you got it. First impulse.
Loon stabs bald eagle through the heart the same week George Floyd is murdered. Every mother knows this fear. Dreams that have kept me up nights. A thick-necked stranger grabs at my infant daughter. The roar of rising waters wresting her from my arms, and now a policeman kneeling on her neck as she calls my name. She is three, and I still dream she is a newborn, my DNA dictating me to organize every part of my life to protect her, my body arranging to become a shield. It just happens. You look into the face of your child, petal soft and gaping like a fish, and you resolve that you would kill for her. The loon was no different. The chick she lay, that she carried across waters, cradled in her wings, grasped to death by the eagle who thought this was just another answer to hunger. But we mothers know the brutal acts possible. The fingers that stroke our infant's hair would stab out a man's eyes without joy, urged to murder by the simple fact of animal justice. And the grief that propelled the mother's beak to pierce the eagle's heart as fast and clean as a bullet is the grief that all mothers flinch to mention. And the man on the ground, as breath failed him, calling out mama as he was murdered by a policeman, is the voice that haunts us. Every mother who heard that call cries out in answer, darling, we are coming.
Megan lives in Portland, Maine with her family. She is co-editor of the anthology, A Dangerous New World, Maine Voices on the Climate Crisis, published by Literal Books. Her work has been published in Rattle, Balancing Act 2, Glass, A Journal of Poetry, Driftwood Press, Sky Island Journal, Literary Mama, and elsewhere. Her chapbook, How We Drift, was published by Blue Lyra Press. Megan Sterling is the associate poetry editor of the Maine Review. and was the featured poet in Frost Meadow Review's Spring 2020 issue, a Dibner Fellow at the 2020 Blackfly Writers Retreat, and a Hunokes Artist Colony resident in 2019 and 2021. These Few Seeds is her debut full-length poetry book, and it is out from Terrapin Books. Welcome to the Saloncast, Megan Sterling.
Thank you so much for inviting me here.
Megan, it's so, so good to have you. Honestly, hearing you read that last poem really, really punched me in the chest and it take me back there. Totally reminds me of that Wanda Coleman poem, Requiem for a Bird Nest. That idea that we all want to love and take care of our children so hard and that we'd do anything for it. And to equate that with violence done on minoritized bodies and violence done on the environment is just one of the cool things rhetorically that this text does again and again. So thank you so much for sharing that. I've been a fan of your poetry for a while.
Thank you.
Yeah, I also want to give some praise and love to the book. I felt like when I was reading this book, Megan, I've always told students, for me, one of the hardest things is writing a love poem. Writing about things that I miss or can't have that I want, or unrequited love, or things I'm angry about. Those poems, I think it's easy to get some traction with them. Writing a love poem is still mysterious and difficult for me. And reading your book, I was just thinking, how did she write so many poems about what she loves? And how do you continue to find new things to say? That this book really does a beautiful job of exploring different aspects of love. And mainly for readers who I hope will go out and get your book, the book centers around a lot of feelings about motherhood and your newborn daughter and nature. All of them are just so tender and so much from the voice of somebody who is in love with her world and the characters in it. Now we want to know everything there is to know about how you wrote that book.
Wow, that's a wonderful and enormous question. I think I'll start with just talking about love a little bit. Love is so complicated. There's so many elements to love. And I think as a mother, an older mother, I had my daughter when I was 38 years old. And there's so many things happening at once. I always thought when I was young that love was something simple, like a beam of like brightly colored light coming from a Care Bear's tummy, right? But like love is actually this enormous braid of hope and fear and longing, terror, joy and exhaustion and disappointment, feeling like a fraud and exhilaration, right? It's all of those things are woven and tangled in every moment of feeling what it is to truly love. And I think that becoming a mother has been for me the portal to access my tenderest truth, because I'm so deeply in love with my little family and my daughter. And it's so hard and it's so amazing. And she's from moment to moment this different being, whether she's like tenderly touching my face and looking at me the way that like I dreamed someone would look at me my whole life. And then like moments later, she's smacking me because like I did something she didn't like. And that's moment to moment. And I'm on this ride. And writing poetry is sort of my way of trying to understand what this ride even is and who I'm becoming, who is actually, I'm so much better than I was because I'm allowing myself to experience the complexity instead of trying to make everything be the Care Bear stare. If that makes any sense.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, love from a distance looks clean, and down on Earth One, down on the surface level, it's a big old mess. Your book does a great job of showing those different facets that it pulls out for you.
Thank you. And I think that the very nature of what I have begun to understand at this moment that love is, mm-hmm. and how it keeps changing, is allowing me to keep writing about it. Because I do. I keep writing about it. I mean, it's really ultimately what I'm writing about in every poem that I write. Whether the subject is something that's happening in the world or something that's happening to a forest or something that's happening to a city or something that's I'm witnessing in the growth of my daughter or in changes in my family, it's all love, all of it. They're all love poems.
I love that idea. And I mean, taking care of something that, and that makes you better. This idea of kind of stewardship. And I think that's so empowering and something that we probably don't think about a lot when we think about acts of service and acts of love. So I was wondering if you can talk about this impulse that happens in the text of this conflating of taking care of the daughter and then also of this impulse as us as humans to take care of the earth and how that kind of stewardship goes hand in hand. Because to love something, you got to take care of it.
Sure. So there's so many things about that, actually. That's such an interesting question. I had hesitated about having a child for a number of reasons, but one was a concern about the arc of our climate. I had been warned by a science professor my senior year of college. He told the class that devastating climate change was going to be here within 15 years. You know, catastrophic hurricanes. I mean, all the things that have been happening were things that he told us back in 2001. And I remember that staying inside of me like this seed of doubt. And then life happens and things change. And I began to feel feelings about wanting to bring a child into the world. So my husband and I, we made the decision and we were able to get pregnant, which is a whole other story. I was pregnant in 2016. And 2016 was a really difficult year.
Could only imagine. And so many of my friends were pregnant during that time too.
The terrible fires that were happening in California, in the Amazon, in Australia. I mean, like the world was on fire. The fires came. So I was living in Asheville, North Carolina, which is where I met my husband. And Asheville, which is sort of like temperate, rainforesty climate, it's very wet, was engulfed in wildfires. So I'm pregnant. It's November. It's election day.
Yeah, I was going to say, you hadn't even talked about politics yet. And you're in the South.
Yeah.
Like, and that's another fire that's happening.
I have been to Asheville with my husband. There are three bookstores within a stone's throw of each other downtown. And when we went there, we asked someone about like, well, can we see there's a book event tonight. Yeah. Like, can we come? And they're all like, oh no, it's booked up. And I said, well, what if somebody doesn't show up? They're all like, they'll all show up. It is a deep indigo dot in a sea of red. It is a dynamic place. Plus you're right, Megan, gorgeous green place. So to see that on fire physically as well as metaphorically must have been quite a dynamic.
It was. And on November 8th, that's right, that's election day. On November 8th, the smoke descended because Asheville is essentially a bowl in the mountains, right? It's this little valley. And so the smoke came into the valley. And I remember I was looking around me and I was like, he's going to win.
Yeah.
I can't walk out in the smoke. I don't want to endanger the baby. So I'm like stuck in the house. You know, the news comes and you find out what happened. And all of those things came together and wove together in my mind of this path that we were going to have to navigate together. As I raised this child, I was bringing her into a country where that man was president for 4 years. I was going to bring her into a world that was on fire. And how do I deal with this? How do I do the right thing by this person that I chose to bring into this world selfishly and unselfishly? And so all of those themes were things that I've been wrestling with since my pregnancy. Well, when you have a little newborn, I barely wrote the first year, but the second year she was around more and then more each year until I put together this collection, just weaving all of this terror about what's happening, grief, guilt, hope, like such deep love, such deep longing to make things right. What can I do to make things right? So, you know, I co-edited this anthology about climate writing and climate art. We raised money through that to go to youth environmental organizations to really help to mobilize and support youth that are working. And then my own work tends to be dealing with all of those themes as well. And so this book, These Few Seeds, the cover art is by a Maine artist named Betty Schottmeyer, and the painting is Snowmelt. But if you look at the painting, which was just strangely coincidental, there are small seeds blowing. You know, there's snow melt and there's devastation, and there's also hope and there's also life. And balancing that, and not just plummeting into negativity, but being able to like be truthful and what it means to be truthful, which means that you look at all of it, the negative and the bad and the beautiful and the good, and that these things are coexisting.
Goodness. What an answer. I mean, shout out to William Blake, you know, in the Romantics, you know, songs of innocence, songs of experience, because it seems like, you know, you're describing that duality almost in like the romantic impulse in that same way.
Nate, you're welcome. I, you know, it's funny, on my first date with my husband, he told me, he's like, you're very romantic, aren't you? I was like, yes, in the truest sense of the word, yes.
Yeah, I always say capital R romantic.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. That's exactly what it is. And I feel like that's what he understood. And how we both knew on our first date, we were both in such deep trouble.
Is your husband a literary buff himself?
Oh yeah, he's a songwriter. We're both half Jewish. We're both creative. We're both sort of these like tall, lanky, long-limbed weirdos.
There you go. That's the universe. That's serendipity for you. So for those who don't know what the distinction is between lowercase romantic and uppercase romantic, Megan, why don't you tell us a little bit about what uppercase romantic means to you?
I suppose for me, in my own words, it's truth seeking and allowing for there to sort of be beauty in all things, a recognition that there's beauty in the forest fire, in a way, you know, going deeply into your feelings about what's happening and recognizing that there's much to learn in examining everything that's happening. I'd say I definitely lean towards the joyful side of life, but I'm a person who feels big things. That's my truth, is allowing myself to feel big things and express big things. And that's being romantic. And also recognizing that in pursuing your truth, you're contributing to the good.
Proverbial snap, snap, snap.
Snap, snap, snap. I mean, and so living your truth, exploring your truth, and allowing yourself to recognize and examine all the complexities, I feel like brings us closer to being the person that we were ultimately meant to be, or you could say who we were when we were small, before the world, you know, intervened and told us we were wrong or weird or all of these other things that the world tells us. So we start to hide it from ourselves, and then we kind of come back. And when you can get through that birthing and kind of come out of that chrysalis on the other side, right, you're contributing to making the world into a place that's hospitable for all of us to live in and all of us to live our truths. That's what, for me, being a capital R romantic is. Being a lowercase romantic, you know, it means like, I don't know, candlelight. I mean, but I'm not even into, like, I think I've gone on like one proper date in my whole life, which was that first date with my husband. So like, even like the word date always made me feel uncomfortable, too much pressure or something. But romantic, you feel all the things big, and you're not afraid to look at what's ugly in yourself. And the closer you get to what's ugly in yourself, the less ugly it becomes.
Mm-hmm. That's lovely. That is a lovely sentiment. And it recalls to me Rilke's famous line, "Beauty is the beginning of terror." The two of them are so interconnected. Every angel is terrifying. But it's that idea that the feelings can be so big and so overwhelming, they might threaten to break you open. And when you're going to surrender to that big truth, capital T, you're asking to be changed. That's going to hurt in some ways, but it's also going to leave you open to something else. I think that I see that happening in your book. There are so many poems where you express something about how loving something so much opens you up to the possibility of being hurt by it or being hurt on its behalf. And it kind of exacerbates the anxiety that you can have around living and growing and being part of the world.
For sure. I mean, I see people limiting themselves because loving is so frightening and you're so vulnerable and you have everything to lose when you love. And I see people shut themselves down and I understand that impulse, but being that I'm a capital R romantic, it's not something that I can allow myself to do. And writing poetry in a lot of ways is, I feel, what keeps me honest and what keeps me in touch with that capital R and that truth. In that I write these poems because the poems allow me to explore the fact that in the veins of love runs like the iron of fear. You know, breathe through it. I mean, like the poem that I wrote about George Floyd, feeling all the feelings there, like this love you felt for this man's and his death, this person you never knew, but how you, we all know each other. We all are each other. Every child I have birthed, every mother is my mother. Every son is my son. And that truth was weighing so heavily on me until I was able to unburden myself through a poem. That's what I feel like my poems actually are. They're all like, sometimes people ask me about my book and I'm like, it's kind of an exorcism, you know, like there's all these ghosts and they are haunting me. And until I get it out, it's going to weigh me down.
No, I can feel that. And especially hearing your awesome definition of romanticism, because it's so close to, you know, Wordsworth's idea of a spontaneous overflow of emotions. And so for you to talk about guarding and respecting and maintaining and protecting those emotions is so really beautiful. And I also heard, you know, some of Keatsian's idea of like negative capability as well, of being able to stand in that kind of uncertainty and be okay. But I think I want to go back to this idea of love, because what Tricia was so aptly paraphrasing, I think, is one of the best quotes from the book that I'm sure everybody and they daddy didn't ask you about, and they mama and they auntie too, because it's so dope. From Memory is a Greek Island, that quote, "I decided here to love all that I was given, line break, no matter how much it hurt." So gorgeous. So could you talk a little bit about that kind of world wisdom that you dropped there? Again, you so aptly talked about how loving something puts you in a vulnerable space, how just that act does that. But can you talk about that willingness to be there and to be the kind of person and speaker who puts themselves in that negative capability to stand in that uncertainty like Keats talked about in that letter so long ago?
It's one of those things where, you know, I was always an awkwardly tender sort of person. You know, always said the thing that made the room quiet and always said the thing. Yeah.
Me
yeah,
too, I mean, girl. Don't be alone. You see totally. Me unmute myself. I'm not going to let you be alone on that. Me
you.
Too, girl.
Well,
me too.
of course, because poets are my people. And it took me a really long time to discover that even about myself. I was always like, why am I so weird? Why am I so weird? And like all these uncomfortable emotions. Oh my God. And then suddenly I was really in my 30s and I was like, I'm a poet. That's why, you know? Oh, okay. Like I can breathe now. But I feel that everything that's happening or that has ever happened to me is a gift that I've been given to learn from and to expand from if I allow it to be something that I learn from and expand from. And that poem that I write that line in, memory. So I mean, as you learn from my book, I've been a big traveler. I'm just very at home being on the road. It's more comfortable for me than actually nesting. That's trickier. You know, being immersed in foreign spaces and with unknown situations and people I've never seen before. Like, everyone is a friend I haven't made yet. Every place is a possibility. I'm reflecting on an ended relationship and recognizing the gift that I was given by it. Because there are relationships in our lives where we're not able to meet each other's needs, or we are for a brief period, and then those needs change and we no longer are able to meet each other's needs. In marriage, in being a parent, there are things that my daughter wants from me that I can't give her, like my entire body. Like, she just wants to like crawl inside, live in my lap. And we can't do this. There has to be a creation of a boundary. But the same is true in my relationship with her. Her tenderness, like, I want to hold it and never let it go. But I have to let it go. And she has to let me go. And we have to love each other despite the fact that there are these necessary separations and necessary boundaries in order for us to fully embody who we are as people. And so we have to accept the love that we're given, and we have to give all the love we can and accept that there are times where we fall short and where the love falls short, and love it and appreciate it anyway.
Mm-hmm. The really deeply cynical part of me is dying to find out how this plays out when she becomes a teenager. Because I've worked with teenagers so long, and you know, there is that part, that time period, that it's different for every child parent, but there is that differentiation part where it becomes such a struggle and such a challenge. And I really hope you're able to give some voice to that in later years, because I think that will be a really interesting part two, continuation, the story rolls on.
For sure. Absolutely. And you know, she and I are so close. We're so close. I mean, she's 4 and a half. She's very much a mama's girl. I've been gone this week. I'm going back home tomorrow. We'll see how my being gone for a week has affected her in terms of that super intense desire she has for my presence. You know, and if everything is healthy, which I hope it is, she is going to individuate as strongly as her attachment is now. And I actually want that for her, because I individuated late, and it's harder further down the road than it is if you can be in a space where that's actually really safe, because I really, truly want to support her in that. You know, I know that that's an easy thing to say before it's actually happening and she's like being difficult and rejecting and all the things that she's going to have to do in order to really discover who she is separate from me. Mm-hmm. But I want that for her.
Yes. I mean, I definitely feel you on that. I was very nice to my parents when I was a teenager. And I think that screwed me up really badly. I think it would have been better if I just, you know, punched them each in the face once when I was 11 and then gotten it over with and individuated. Because otherwise, I think it made me too nice and I didn't learn how to, you know, kick people when they needed to be kicked. So, you know, there's no right way to raise a child, and it's going to be painful whatever you do. And if not, you're not doing it right, you know?
Absolutely. The whole thing is just risk after risk after risk.
We'll get back to that interview in a moment. If you enjoy this podcast and want to learn more about us, log on to thepoetrysalon.com.
Most writers need a community around them to sustain their motivation and excitement for writing. The mission of the Poetry Salon is to provide inspiration, education, and support for poets everywhere at a price that is affordable.
Together, we are building a thriving community through online classes, e-courses, and readings. so you have the tools to live the life of a growing, prolific, accountable writer.
You also get opportunities to share your work and receive supportive feedback. Then turn your finished pieces into journal submissions, building an audience for your writing.
Again, visit thepoetrysalon.com to find out more and register today. Hearing you talk about motherhood, it's really been inspiring and beautiful as somebody, you know, who just recently got married and wanting to be in a family way. And I remember reading Lucille Clifton talk about how motherhood, how she had always been writing. One of the things she said that happened, though, is that it made her poem smaller and quicker. And then I think about my dear friend, Sarah Vapp, and she said that being a mother made her poems kind of a poet of interruption. And like she, in her latest book, Winter Influences, in that text, she would enact those interruptions. Like she would be writing and then she would just, that poem would stop and she would say, Archie, grab my leg, or my child, grab my leg, et cetera, et cetera. And then just write that into the process so you can see it like brain on the page. So where I'm landing is how do you think motherhood and pregnancy informed, changed, deepened, enhanced, altered your writing?
It's a great, great question. On a lot of levels it did. For one, you have less time to do it, which I was just telling someone this morning, in some ways has been a gift. I have to be more efficient and more truthful in a shorter period of time. And so
I think that's what Clifton was getting at, right? By saying I have to be quicker and totally.
Yes. So it's like honed that muscle, the like getting things down. You have the, either you have a time set in your schedule that you write a poem and, you know, you've just got that muscle trained to just sit your ass down and just start writing whatever comes out. Or you have an idea for a poem and then you sit your ass down and then it comes, but you have an hour maybe to get it out. I was getting up early and writing before my daughter woke up, but then she was on to me. And so then it's like the moment the computer would open, it's like, she like knew and would come in and completely sabotage all of my efforts to get my time in while she was anywhere in the vicinity. So I have to do it when she's not. So I've become more efficient and more truthful with myself. I don't have time for meandering. I don't have time for self-doubt. That's been the big change for me. I mean, I spent my whole, until I was like 38 years with confidence issues and self-esteem issues and self-doubting issues. And I'm not good. And you know, I don't have anything to say and who cares and, you know, all that kind of crap. And then something clicked in my mid-30s. Well, I married my wonderful and supportive husband, who's also a creative person. And that makes a big difference. Just coming into my age and realizing I wanted a child, and the process of going about that was me really trusting my intuition, which told me that I needed to undergo a procedure in order to have my child. And I started listening to that voice, and then, you know, getting pregnant and having her inside of me. And suddenly I mattered to myself. I was holding her and carrying her. I was important. And that's changed everything. So, and then like having her, and she comes out and like, is everything and everywhere and on me. You know, I nursed her till she was almost two and she's still on me. Like I'm peeing and she's coming in the bathroom and crawling into my lap and licking my nose. That is happening like every morning. And I don't have time to like worry, like, do I have anything to say? Is it any good? Like, don't care. Don't have time. I'm just writing. I'm just doing it. I'm just putting it out there. It's like, I have self-belief I didn't have.
I think that's wonderful. And not everyone has to have a child or just have an extremely busy life in order to force that. Because I've heard that from so many other poets, one of the ways that they will get past overthinking things is to give themselves a timer. I think, in fact, Elizabeth Gilbert gave this piece of advice to a writer who was struggling. She said, just set a timer and write for 15 minutes. Yes. And after the timer goes off, you can't write anymore. You know, so I think there are some ways to artificially create that sense of, I don't have enough time to worry.
Right, right. And it's something you come to, that epiphany with a big capital E, where you suddenly realize that you don't have to spend all that time fretting about yourself anymore. Somehow it's almost not about you anymore. It's about the work. You start to trust what comes. It isn't like everything that just comes out is great, because that's not true. But you start to allow the work to be what it is without inserting yourself and your ego and your self-esteem into it. Because when you start doing that, you start writing for the wrong reasons and for the wrong audience. Then who are you anyway? And who is the speaker? There's no truth there if you're not really actually writing for yourself. And I now write for, I am my own audience. I don't think about somebody I went to college with 20 years ago who didn't think I was very smart. I don't think about a professor from graduate school that I'm trying to impress. I only think about, if this is something that moves me, then it matters to me. I send it out in the universe. And I've had a lot of really positive responses and feedback from just trusting that self.
Yeah, just that, again, this kind of search for meaning through love and through being vulnerable, I think, is something we've returned to again and again, and I love it. And so, you know, we've talked a lot about that first poem that you've read, but can you give a little bit of backstory? Because that was the easiest one, right? That first poem you read, that was the easiest one for you?
You mean Before School There Are Icicles?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. That, you're right.
All right. So could you talk a little bit, give us a backstory, let us in the kitchen, if you will. Let me look over your shoulder while you're making the nice recipe. Let me know. What's up?
That's so funny, because I actually do not like to cook at all.
Oh, you guys can come over to my house. All I do during this pandemic is cook now. Anyway, sorry.
My pandemic activity has been running. I trained for a marathon. It's what I do to have that same kind of release where my mind is empty, but my body's moving as I run. But it works together with the poetry in a way, because it helps me clear the slate clean to sort of begin afresh. Or if there's a poem that I'm struggling with, if I go for a run, I often can come back to it with kind of new eyes. I've been born again.
Yeah, yes. Nietzsche has that quote, never trust a thought that wasn't made in motion.
Cool.
Definitely.
So going into the kitchen to look at this poem. So the poem Before School There Are Icicles was an easy poem. It was a poem that essentially composed itself in my body, in the experience of being with my daughter. There had been an ice storm in probably early to mid-February in Portland. And we went out into it in the morning before I took her to her care. And we just sort of played in it. And there were these icicles that came clattering, as I say in the first line, but they just came shining and crashed down onto the frost. And that moment for me was the start of a feeling that we had this experience together, my daughter and I. We were on this ice that was so treacherous. And, you know, she's so little, and so I'm so protective, but I'm also trying not to fall on my ass. You know, she wants to hear the music of the icicles, so I'm playing the icicles in this tree. And then she wants to taste some icicles, so I get some icicles for her to taste in this tree. And then she wants to go get some icicles from that tree. So we're like trying to totter over on this icy driveway over to the other tree. And we're just having this experience in this just absolutely diamond-studded landscape. And then eventually I'm able to coax her into the car, and I take her. And then I come home before I started my other work. I wrote this poem, and it was like the fantasy that the poet has, where you basically, you go under and you come out for air and the poem has been born. It was like that. I have a friend who calls it a live birth. It just arrived, because the experience itself, it was already like in my being, everything about it. It was alive, and I just had to sort of connect the dots quickly. I probably spent, like an hour at the most crafting this thing. and came up for air, maybe changed a few words, a few line breaks, and then I sent it off. And it won a poetry contest.
Yeah, I love that. I love when they just come out your body like that. And yeah, just to think about that, you got out of the way of that poem. And I think a lot of times when we really start vibing, it's because we just got out the way.
We just channel, right? Yeah. You just channel.
I think that really goes back to the topic of romanticism, capital R. It's all about transcendence, which I think the very close cousins of the romantics, the transcendentalists, it's about getting back to nature, getting rid of the chatter that's in your head, the judgments, the social influences, and letting the natural world speak to you. I don't know that it always has to be the natural world. I think you could have a romantic experience writing about paperclips or something man-made. It's
the sound of your heater
or your heels. Megan, I love what you said. The poem composed itself in my body. That is just a lovely way of putting it. I've never heard anyone explain it that way before. Do you think if you had left it there, it would have stayed, or was it necessary to write it down right then in that moment?
Oh, you have to birth something when it's ready to be birthed. Anyone who's had a kid, you know, when the kid's ready to come, the kid just comes out, can't hold that back. No, I think it had to be written. I think that that's part also of the living it and allowing it to be born, is that you allow it to come to fruition. The poems for me that are the easy ones to write are the ones that are this way, which is that I have a lived experience of some kind. And again, it doesn't have to be running around with my daughter carefully, running around with my daughter outside on the ice. It can be something much more mundane. It can be folding socks. It can be looking out the window and noticing a moving van. It can be seeing a neighbor cut down a tree. It can be suddenly your jeans don't fit, right? Like, it can be all of these things. But the important thing is that, like, there's this sensation of something about this means more than just the experience itself. And then getting out of the way and letting the poem come. And the poem tells you what it means that there's this tree being cut down, what it means that your jeans don't fit. All of those understandings, it's almost as if they're just kind of subconscious or sort of underneath the surface of your skin. And if you allow yourself to have the space for it to be born, it tells you what it all means. And so those are the easy ones. The harder ones are the ones that come from here.
So, I mean, we're right there rhetorically. Let's do it, right? Talk about the hard one. What happens when it's a hard birth, when that baby don't want to come? And I think I already get it with already hearing the subject matter of that piece and thinking about it, that poem steps into that political landscape. You have the detail that all of us talked about from that 9-minute awful, awful murder is, you know, I can't ever not hear him call for his mother. Mm-mm. Wearing the body that I wear, being the age that I am, knowing what's happened to my brother who's 12 years older than me, knowing what's happened to my father, to his father, to his father, to his father, knowing that there were 12 generations in slavery and never knew the end of it, and America still won't act like it happened. Yeah. And so, again, I got a feeling of why that poem was difficult, but could you talk a little bit more about that, my dear friend?
Sure. There were so many reasons why it was hard. For one, there was the murder of George Floyd and the way it wrecked people who care, right? Like, people who care, I mean, I'll never be the same. So many terrible things had happened leading up to that moment. But for so many people, that moment was the murder of ourselves, the murder of our family. So there was this terrible, heavy, heavy pain. And I often find when something is very heavily painful, I'm too close to write about it, right? Also, as a white woman, There is some discomfort about whether I had the right to write about this feeling that I was having. So it was heavy and sitting and weighing on me. I just was letting it sit because there wasn't a way to write about this that felt okay for me to do. And then a few days later in Maine, there was a news story about a bald eagle that had been found dead, floating in a body of water next to a dead baby loon chick. And it was, you know, this mystery. And when they investigated, they saw that the way that the eagle died was that its heart was completely pierced through by something. And they thought it must be a bullet. So they did tests and they found it wasn't a bullet. It was the beak of a mother loon. And for me, that was the entrance. Because when I heard that story, I recognized myself in these stories, the mother that was called for, and the mother loon that killed the eagle. And I thought about it though. So I had the entrance. I understood what the poem in some ways was going to be grappling with. I understood the path I was going to walk down. But I wanted to really think about it because this is a very sensitive subject. In some ways, I didn't want to appropriate this in the way that I know a lot of people were appropriating it. And so I sat down, I gave myself a chunk of time, and I thought, how can I tell this story that I'm feeling growing inside of me about what is happening and what has happened and what's been happening? And I got the first line. It was, every mother knows this fear. And there it was. For me, the first line is always the key. The title, sometimes, if the title is a title that leads into a poem or really defines the poem, often that's the lead-in, but I have to get that first line or else I can't make sense. I mean, I know some poets can write, maybe they can write an end or maybe they can write a middle, but like I have to start at the beginning. I mean, I guess that makes me a narrative poet in a way because, you know, I tell stories and I have to start at the beginning. And so for me, the beginning was the terror that a mother feels about her child and the terrible sort of gruesomeness of not being able to protect someone calling out for their mother.
I want to give you props and respect for being, you know, not an ally, but an accomplice by writing about the subject matter that you did with that poem. And I think the real cool rhetorical move, and Sarah's book does this a lot too, is that idea, like not only the mothering and the protecting, and like thinking about Floyd calling for his mother, but then to do that next rhetorical leap of understanding that fear to protect, right? Because that leads to a state that does things like that man did,
right,
for 9 minutes. And it's that fear, and that's one of the cool moments in Sarah's book, and it happens in your book as well, that awareness that it's that same fear, that crazy fear of protection that leads to that kind of violence. And so that's why that story with that loon is so deep and powerful, because it's those bothness, and it's that bothness that you also talk about when you talk about the protection of the environment and your child as well. So that's, it's great. Protection to a fault and protection on the good end. And that bothness, my dear friend, is the complexity, the paradoxical nature of poetry that makes poetry slap. So just thank you for that complexity. Great. Seriously.
Thank you for seeing that and recognizing that. That is something that I touch on that I think most people haven't addressed with me, that I'm looking at different perspectives and the urge to violence and where it comes from and feeling the way that loon, I mean, I just have pictured over and over in my mind that loon, right? That instinct. I mean, she just went at that bald eagle and pierced its heart and it dropped dead clutching her chick, right? And the two floating off in the water, and just the power of the desire for revenge and the power of hate and rage and what it leads us to do.
Well, and that's one of the other aspects of love, isn't it? Because I forget who said this, but the opposite of love is not hate, it's indifference. Some people have the ability to imagine themselves into another person's shoes. To quote Naomi Shihab Nye, to realize that that could be you on the road walking with the hope for the future. That could be you. And some people, I think, especially poets and artists, feel that way. That loon is like me. Every other person on the planet is like me. I could be them. They could be me. And then there are some people who don't have or haven't cultivated that imaginative faculty. So I think that does so much of what, again, the capital R romantics were asking us to do, is go out and let yourself be part of nature and part of the world and realize that you are, in fact, connected to this big, larger organism.
Absolutely. Just this idea that everyone is a mirror, everyone is us, and we are everyone with all of our different experiences and different privileges, just trying to come at everything with that love and that recognition of worth and worthiness just is, it's just, it's for me, one of the most important ways of living a life. And it's why I did this thing that, you know, is risky. Again, you know, it's about risking, you know, risking people being upset or risking people being uncomfortable or risking being misunderstood or.
I think this is a question we should probably ask more frequently, but makes me think, I don't think, Megan, I've asked you at all what or who are some of your big influences, and especially for this book. Who were you reading? Who do you think kind of influenced this? Who do you recommend we go on to read?
Wow, what a great question. Who was
Who's in your canon? Who's in your canon? That's another way I ask people.
Oh my goodness. So I think a lot of what informed the reading of this book was probably Sharon Olds, because she writes so much about the experience of the body and the experience of children, because so much about children is about the body, them being in your body, them coming out of your body, the way your body has changed permanently from them being in it and coming out of it. And then you're, you know, diapering them and wiping them and bathing them. And so skin and moisture. And so much is about that. And also she's, of course, weaving into the, all of that, that intense and fierce love, that grief that comes with the loss that is either happening or will happen or has happened. And so she's someone that I read a lot, probably in the making of this book. I mean, Mary Oliver also, to an extent, there are things she does that I do. I like the way that she sees the self in nature and nature in the self, that it's this mirror, and that's so important in preserving nature, conserving and caring about others and caring about trees. You know, if you look at the tree and the tree is just this other, who cares? But if you look at the tree and you feel that the tree is a being the way that you're a being, and even though its beingness is different than your beingness, there is a connection, then you care about whether that tree is cut down or not.
Yeah.
Right.
Have you ever read Mark Doty or Mark Doty's The Art of Description?
I've read some Mark Doty. I've never read The Art of Description.
He has a great line in there about, very similar to what you were saying about Mary Oliver, that if you know the proper names for things, like if you know the name of this plant,
yes,
something specific, like you're going to care more if it's mowed down, if the field of this particular plant is destroyed.
Yes.
So, yeah, something like that.
Also, Jane Hirschfield and Louise Gluck, Denise Levertov, Joy Harjo. I really, is that how you pronounce her name? Harjo?
I've been told Harjo. I've been pronouncing it Harjo.
And Glick too. It's, I've been told
Glick.
I've been told there's an accent. Don't get me lying. Wow.
Louise Glick and Joy Harjo. Like mothers, women in particular, I particularly like reading women poets. So lately I've been reading a lot of Diane Seuss. That's been fantastic and really informing a lot of what I'm writing currently.
Those are some great recommendations, Megan. I'm really excited to see what your next collection is. I'm excited to read this one a second time too. I really just have enjoyed it so much. It's a great book to read out in the woods or on a cold day when it's raining and you're indoors and you wish you were out in the woods. It's a great way to learn about the many ways that having a child can open you up to different forms of love. It's just, it's a beautiful book. Once again, it is These Few Seeds, out from Terrapin Books. And the author is Megan Sterling, currently is in Maine. You guys are very distracting. Doug and Megan right now are making little heart shapes out of their hands. And sending.
It's for the juju. It's for the juju. It makes everything feel better. I thought I was going to empower you, my dear friend.
So I have to tell you just this little quick thing. I discovered your podcast in January. I discovered it through a binder who put a link to one of the episodes. And I listened to it and I got completely obsessed. So I was winter running in the snow. This is the first year I've ever done that, which was amazing. I would come home from my run, like all snowy, and I'd be like, Matthew, I found this amazing podcast and one day I'll be on it. One day in the far future, I will be on this podcast. And then you emailed me in May and I was like, what? How did that happen that I'm in May? She wants me on her podcast. I thought like maybe in like 2023.
Oh my gosh. No. I don't know. That
was the like vision I had. I was going to be, you know, have a few more gray hairs and a few more books under my belt. And then you'd notice me.
No, of course. I mean, this is the magic of social media. It really is. And thank you so much. That story is really touching. I'm often the person in that position. So it's so very surreal, pleasantly surreal to be on the other end of that. But no, your work is just terrific and your book is beautiful. Get prepared for more. You got a book out there now and you're on social media and you're doing a good job of promoting yourself and others and poetry in general. And so expect some more invites. And also don't be afraid to go out there and get yourself invited. Tell everyone you know who has a podcast.
What's your sign, Megan? We always do this on the show too. What's your sign?
Oh, straight up Sagittarius.
Oh,
that's why we vibe. Nice.
What are you
I'm
all?
A Leo.
Oh, yeah. My marriage.
I'm abusively a Leo. Of course you are. Saggies love us.
Oh, yeah. What are you?
I am a Pisces, but my moon is in Sagittarius and my husband is a Sagittarius. So I got a lot of Sag energy, a lot of like, hey, let's light it on fire and just see what happens. Do you want to do a random act of kindness? How about a senseless act of beauty? Please rate and review us and write a comment on this episode.
It helps us get heard, get seen, and it helps other poets find us in the chaotic distractions of cyberspace.
Are you a poet who wants to be interviewed on the Poetry Salon cast? Contact Trisha@thepoetrysalon.com and send some of your work to be considered.
And don't forget that this writer will be teaching a guest workshop on the last Sunday of this month at 2 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. To purchase tickets, write to Trisha@thepoetrysalon.com.
Thanks again for being part of our community. And whoever writes the worst draft wins!
Yay!